So where I'm going with this, in a post-COVID world, if we want to call it that, now more than ever, you have to find your voice. And I was in so much pain. Had I been able to, I would have called 911, or my husband Anthony, he would have came over, because I knew something was really wrong and they were discharging me.
Cue music. Places, everybody, places. We're starting in 3, 2.
Welcome to the Autoimmune Hour, where we look at the rise of autoimmune disorders. I've brought together top experts that range from doctors, specialists, nutritionists, researchers, and even those recovering from autoimmune to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information about autoimmunity and how to live your life uninterrupted.
Thank you for joining us here on the Autoimmune Hour with Sharon Saylor. Always seek sound legal, medical, and or professional advice regarding any problems, conditions, and any of the recommendations you see, hear, or read here on the Autoimmune Hour, Understanding Autoimmune and Life Interrupted Radio. Join the Autoimmune Hour's Courage Club. Sign up now at understandingautoimmune.com. Now, back to your host, Sharon Saylor.
Welcome, everyone, to the Autoimmune Hour. I'm Sharon Saylor from SharonSaylor.com. And as always, it's my honor and privilege to be with you here on another brand new episode. And we're going into the 400s. As you know, just a few weeks ago, we celebrated our 400th episode. I'm so excited that the community is still growing strong. And I'm just loving each and every one of you. Thank you for reaching out to us and letting us know about great guest ideas, about what's going on in your life. We really appreciate that. And as you know, our social media is Understanding Autoimmune over on Instagram and Facebook at Understanding Autoimmune, as well as you can find all the previous episodes over at understandingautoimmune.com. And in this episode, we have a really interesting guest, because not only does she have some autoimmune herself, but she's here to talk to us about an experience that she had with her mom. And she wrote a lovely book. And this is really a painful, true story about a family's crisis with stage 4 ovarian cancer and an unbelievable ordeal they went through to get her mother quality care. So tonight we're having Melissa Malamphy on. She is a psychologist, a healthcare expert, a patient advocate, and a critically acclaimed author of Not in Vain, A Promise Kept. And this is all about putting her life on hold to help her mother during her cancer diagnosis and her cancer treatment. And she saw firsthand all the failures of a broken medical system. And I want to put, was clear back in 2010. It's taken her 10 years to come to terms with what happened and to write her story. This is not about post-COVID. She tells the story of a system of really good people working in a really tough situation, critically deficient framework, as she calls it. So welcome to the show, Melissa. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, I read your book and I was nodding along with, oh, wow, I get that. I've experienced something similar, and also very shocked and surprised at times. And there was one line in your early on in your book where I just resonated so much that I said, we have to have Melissa on the show. And I'm going to quote it for you. It's, sometimes you have to be an insufferable asshole to get things done. Trust me when I tell you that.
Yes. Yes. And I was many times throughout my mom's journey and continue to be.
Well, I felt sort of like a soul sisterhood going on there. And I think a lot of our community here will really understand what you mean by that when we talk about not only what your mom went through, but what you went through and continue to go through. So, Melissa, let's just tell a little bit about you and your story so they have an understanding of where this powerful raw account came from.
Sure. I grew up in a small town called Brewster, which is about an hour northwest from New York City. Came from a, I would say, middle income home, lived in 800 square foot house, regular family, mom, dad both worked, had one sister. And my mom, you know, she was of the era of people. She was 68 when she was diagnosed. she kind of didn't go to doctors. She didn't like doctors. She avoided doctors. And she had not gone to a gynecologist since she had me. And she was diagnosed when I was 39. So it had been a long time since she had gone. They're called the silent generations. And one of the things when you look them up is they are, they're not, it's not like they're not rule followers, but they don't like to go to doctors. They don't want to be burdens, et cetera, et cetera. So
when I think about my mom and dad, very self-sufficient, self-reliant, pull themselves up by the bootstraps and don't complain very much.
Yep. I mean, listen, my mom at 68, she was waiting tables for 40 years since I was born. She was waiting tables. The night before we went to the emergency room, she was still carrying around trays of spaghetti. So that just shows the strength that she had. She barely went to the doctor. So when she called me and said that she was crying and she said that she had like distension in her stomach and she knew it was something bad. And so we went to the emergency room and the ER physician walked in and he kind of took one look at her. And even though his words said, could be this, could be that, when he brought in the contrast drink for a CT, I could tell by his facial expression that something wasn't good. When he came back, he wanted to talk to my mom and dad in private. They found a 23 centimeter mass on my mom's ovary. That's big. You know, said it could be benign. You know, they're not always cancer, but you need to follow up with your GP on Monday. And, you know, with that, we all left. But the whole time, she was confident that that's what it was. And looking hindsight, after she passed, I'm jumping ahead, but when we found stuff in her house, she was self-treating. You know, she had stuff for UTIs. She was trying everything to sort of try and treat. She was taking meds for GERD because, you know, sometimes doctors mistake it for GI issues. I have a GP that's old school. I called him up and I said, hey, doctor, this is what's going on. My whole family went in and he said, you know, oh my God, you're so distended. But at the same time, he said, you know, could be benign. It's very common. They're benign. He was always very positive. But again, we still left with the business cards of an oncologist and a business card of a gynecologist oncologist. So you don't want to leave with those referrals. So that started our journey. And this is back in 2010. Now it's 100 times worse. But we needed to make an appointment like yesterday, because as if you don't know, ovarian cancer for women, especially if it's staged out, is usually caught after menopause, and usually because the symptoms are hide themselves as GI symptoms, or women don't go to the doctor until it becomes so bad. Usually when it's found, it's very staged out and difficult to treat. Out of all the female cancers, it's the worst you can get and the deadliest. We, you know, try to get an appointment. They're like, you know, and this is back in 2010. They're like, we don't have an opening for 3 weeks. And I'm like, we can't wait 3 weeks. And this is before a pandemic. So this is where the insufferable asshole starts. You know, it's like, we got to get an appointment. And, you know, we just kept trying and just call every single day, be nice about it, but just call every single day. Is there a cancellation, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, we got in. Dr. Z in the book. At first, my sister and I would call her the Grim Reaper because everything she had to say was scary and just scary. You know, first thing came out of her mouth was, this is not a friendly cancer. These are the things that could happen, et cetera, et cetera. And me and my sister were like, come on, give us a little bit of hope. But you know what? Every hypothesis that woman had came true. Everything that she said could go wrong did go wrong. Looking hindsight, although sometimes we were like, oh God, we don't want to know, I was glad for the transparency from the beginning, because the oncologist, and again, I've come a long way, I understand they have a very hard job. We had false hope, and my mom was put through the ringer unnecessarily. You know, what she had to do was, because she had not been to many doctors, they wanted to schedule her for surgery, but you can't do surgery unless you are surgery okay. So they had to do a colonoscopy on her. They had to do endoscopy on her. They had to do a mammogram. They had to do a bone marrow test. Like, they needed to do all the, she had to play catch up for everything that she hadn't done for 40 years for regular annual maintenance kind of stuff. Not that you get bone marrow checks for maintenance, but things that she should have had done, she didn't get done. Like, they had no baseline to compare anything to. So we had to start from square one. But the good news is we got all of that done in short order, and it came back all good. So we were set up for surgery, I would say within 3 weeks of diagnosis, which was okay timing. Went for her pre-op blood. Your platelets are supposed to be between 250,000 and 450,000. Hers are 1.2 million, which is, it's a thrombotic disorder, and it's caused by cancer. So what happens when you have that is it makes you a very high stroke risk on the operating table. So she was admitted to the hospital. She had to be hooked up to a machine that's similar to like dialysis, where they take all your blood, put it through a machine, and somehow it reduces the platelet count in order for her to have surgery. So she was scheduled for the next day, but because Dr. Z didn't like the way my mom looked, she was a little tachycardic the evening before, they decided they wanted to wait. And they wanted to do neoadjunctive chemotherapy, which means we're going to give you chemo first to try and, quote unquote, shrink the tumor. And that will make it easy for us to do surgery in 3 months. So we said, you know, we didn't want this to happen, but at this point, you have no choice. So they try and err on the side of hope. Chemotherapy, it's kind of a layup, no worries, it's easy. So her first round of chemo was done inpatient. She came out, she got dressed, she put makeup on. She was like, oh, that was easy. Dr. Z had already explained to us, you really don't start to feel symptoms till like the second or the third. So prior to the third, a couple things happened. One, she had ascites. When you have cancer, any tumor that you have surrounds itself with ascites. Ascites is a fluid. Because my mom had it in her abdomen, that fluid rises and then makes it hard for you to breathe, makes it hard for you to eat. So what they have to do is they put you into inpatient radiology and they take a big needle and they get it out. Cancer was so aggressive. My mom was having to get, it's called paracentesis. She was having to get it sometimes twice a week just for comfort. That's part one. Part two is when they canceled the surgery, they said, we're going to do a 24-hour biopsy. You'll know within 24 hours if this is cancer, because we were still kind of not sure. 4 days later, a nurse came in, and me and my sister were in my mom's room. And she comes in, and you know, now I can say it. She was dressed in like COVID protocol, you know, the mask, the yellow outfit. It was like she was going into chemical warfare. I had never seen it, but now we're used to seeing it. And we're like, can we help you? And she's like, Miss Burns, we're here for your chemotherapy. We're like, what? What do you mean chemotherapy? We have no diagnosis yet. Oh, no. Well, Dr. X told me I need to start this cisplatin. You know, we need to start chemo now. And my sister just, again, because we're so unfamiliar with it, it's like, why are you wearing all that stuff? And she's like, well, this is poison and I don't want to get it on me. And, you know, oh, by the way, can I have your vein? That's how we found out she had cancer.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
I got on the phone with the oncologist and I'm like, are you kidding me? We have no prognosis, no staging, no diagnosis, nothing. And this is how we're finding out. So he finally came in, explained it all to us. Weren't happy about it, but we had to take it. It was what it was. But what if me and my sister weren't there? Like, this poor nurse, like, she kind of drew the short straw. She had that round of chemo, came home, and I had a really good job at the time, and my bosses were great. So one night when my mom was getting paracentesis, my sister noticed her breathing was weird, and I happened to see the oncologist in the hallway, and I said, please come look at my mom. She's breathing kind of weird. And he looked at her, and he said, I think she's fine, but just to be safe, we'll admit her to cardiology. Stayed with her that night. She wound up having bilateral pulmonary embolisms in one in each lung and bilateral DVTs. Cancer causes clots. What happened in cardiology was one evening after work, I stopped there. It was a teaching hospital. My mom was on Ativan, which is a benzodiazepine. She was also on pain meds and she was on a sleeping pill. So she was kind of out of it. And a student came in and asked her what her end of life wishes were. And, you know, my mom said to him, if there's no hope, I don't want anything. That's all she said. And with that, he took his clipboard and left. And I said, Ma, I said, you just told him that if you have a cardiac arrest tonight, not to do anything. She goes, no, I didn't. I said, yes, you did. I went to down the hallway. I had him come back in. And I said, what did you hear my mom want as far as DNR wishes? He's like, she doesn't want anything. It's DNR. I said, absolutely not. I said, if she has a cardiac arrest tonight, you do whatever you need to do to save her. I said, what she meant to say was, like a lot of people say, is I don't want a feeding tube and I don't want to be put on a vent. But she didn't say that. You know, with that, he updated his records and left. Then I'm leaving. You know, she had a lot of IVs in. And I happened to look at her wrist. And I don't know why I did, but I just did. Her name was Constance. And I look at her bracelet and it's another woman's name.
Oh, my goodness.
I wasn't thinking about lawsuits or anything like that or catching anybody. I didn't think to take a picture. I just called the nurse and said, this is a big problem. You need to fix it. And they got rid of it quick. You're so-and-so. You're not who you are. So that was like a big moment. And all of these things, I made sure the patient advocate knew every single time. And I was always very nice, very courteous. She said, they apologized and she would say, well, you know, we're going to speak to the group and et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, patient advocates, for the most part, are on the same payroll from the hospital as the doctors or nurses that might make mistakes. So it's in my opinion that a lot of patient advocates should be consultants because there is a bias as far as how far they may go in, you know, some of these issues. If I hadn't found that, you know, what would have happened? And at the end of each chapter, I write what I learned, what I would do differently, and what you need to do as an advocate. Because every month of the book is a month from when she was diagnosed to when she passed away to current today, because it was released at the end of last year. My sister was great at writing down everything. She kept a journal, meds, who prescribed the meds, interdisciplinary practices like autoimmune. Me and you probably have five different specialties. Do they know what each other is prescribing? And especially for a cancer patient, weight, because as you waste, you lose weight. You don't see overweight cancer patients. It's very rare. So she was wasting. Her mind was bad. Cognitively, she was depressed. We didn't see much hope. And we said, before we put her through another round of chemotherapy, we want to get another CAT scan to see if this is working because we were told it should start shrinking the tumor. The oncologist told my sister that the tumor shrunk in half. So we're doing the jig. We're like, oh my God, this is working. I remember me and my sister went out and had a glass of wine. I mean, we were thrilled. It was something was working. My mother was thrilled, you know, maybe I'm actually going to make it. The next week, my sister goes to the oncologist, gynecologist, Dr. Z. And, you know, she was very, very clinical, very, very smart. She didn't mess around. And she looked at my mom's films prior to the appointment with the radiologist and nothing changed. In fact, the tumor grew. So we were given the wrong information and we had already given my mother the third round of chemotherapy. So we made a sick lady sicker because the idea of having a CAT scan prior to giving her the third round was if it wasn't working, we need to get surgery done yesterday because she's wasting. In comes August, you know, there's a couple hospitalizations here and there. And you know, another thing I write in the book is befriend your nurses. They make or break your care. To me, especially in oncology, I never met one that I didn't like. I never met one that I had a problem with. They're always very empathetic. We got to know them and treated them with the respect that they deserved. So now we are in the end of July. She's wasting. She's got a CAT scan that shows chemo isn't doing anything. We tried everything, green drinks, tough love. Like now I even regret it because I remember calling her once and saying, like giving her like the hard love thing, like Ma, you want to beat this thing, right? You know, if you want to beat it, you know, you got to eat. What I didn't realize at the time, and I regret it, is when they did the surgery, she had cancer all the way up to her diaphragm. So besides the ascites, she had no room to eat anything. And that's another thing. You need to be present in the rooms at different times, especially if you have cancer. If I was there on a Saturday with her for 8 hours, I know if cafeteria services came in with three trays of food And out of the three trays of food, she drank half a boost because that was common. It's not cafeteria service's fault. It's the system's fault. But calorie intake, if you have cancer, is critical. So I got to the point where before big appointments with the main doctors, if I couldn't be there or my sister, I would fax them everything that I kind of saw during the week. And that could be something like she's not eating, her mind isn't good, they're worried about finances. I mean, it was all over the board. You know, what somebody that's treating you needs to know, you need to treat the whole person, not just the gallbladder in room 120. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things that are going on. At the end of July, they told us the earliest they could get us in was October. This is where the Scorpio, the New Yorker, whatever you want to call me, all the disciplines she needed to have, anesthesia, oncology, gynecology, the oncologist, and a bowel doctor in the operative room. Because of all the surgeries she might need, she may have come out with a colostomy bag. So they need to have all those people available. And again, this is going back to 2010. It's not like today. It's worse now. They couldn't schedule her to October. And I said, by October, she's dead. So all of the secretaries that made appointments for the doctors sat in one room. My father and my sister and my mother were in the patient room, you know, the outpatient room with the surgeon. My mother was crying. The doctor was pacing. I just went out into the waiting room. I opened the door that they were all making the appointments for. And I took a chair from the waiting room and I took it and I sat down and they're like, excuse me, can we help you? And I said, I'm not leaving until you make an appointment. And they're like, you can't be here. And I said, I'm not leaving until you make an appointment. And they're like, I'm sorry, ma'am, call security. I'm not leaving till you make an appointment. And my mom's doctor, the oncologist, gynecologist, Dr. Z, knew that I would have stayed there. And thankfully, she got on her cell phone, started making phone calls. We wound up getting scheduled for August 4th. So the night before surgery, me and my sister are there late, and the surgeon comes up, Dr. Z, and says, you know, I don't like your mom's case. I'm nervous and, you know, it might be palliative. You know, she says, if you see me in an hour, that means I opened her up and I shut her and there's nothing we could do. And I'm like, oh my God, you're telling me this at 9:30 at night and we're the 6 o'clock case. But you know what? I was glad that she was honest and she was honest throughout. So that morning, you know, when we went, we all went as a team. I didn't tell my dad or my sister that. I just knew that because she took me outside of the room. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm just waiting like, oh, man, I hope I don't see her in an hour. And 9 hours later, she comes out and they said they optimally debulked her and they got everything. And even she was crying. We were all crying. And they had admitted her to inpatient rehab. In inpatient rehab, you know, she was in there for a couple of weeks, OT, PT, speech. She didn't need speech. But she called me one morning. She's like, you know, Missy, I'm really dizzy. They started me on a new med. And I'm like, what do you mean they started me on a new med? And she read me the name. And I'm like, Ma, that's for high blood pressure. I'm like, you have low pressure. You're hypotensive, not hypertensive. So get in my car and go over there. You can't do anything over the phone. You got to go in person. I go over there. I see the guy that's in charge of the rehab. And I said, why'd you put my mom on a high blood pressure medication? I said, she's hypotensive. I said, she's going to pass out. And I said, she's dizzy. And basically he's like, I'm the doctor. I know what I'm talking about. Hit the bricks. And so with that, I got in my car, drove over to the cardiologist appointment because she had a separate cardiologist. And I walked in there. She's got a room full of patients. And I said, I'm so-and-so's daughter. I need to see doctor, her cardiologist. And, you know, they're like, you don't have an appointment. And I'm like, I'll wait. It's really important that I speak to her. And it wasn't like I was already on the campus and making a phone call just doesn't work. She came out and she was very nice. And she's like, can I help you? And I'm like, listen, Dr. So-and-so put my mom on a hypertensive med. She's dizzy. I know she's always hypotensive. I said, I question it. He told me, mind my business. And I'm afraid she's going to fall. And I basically told him before I left, I said, if she falls and breaks her hip, you're 100% responsible. So she immediately took her off that medication. And I told her not to take it before I left to go see the cardiologist. But every single step through my mom's care, we ran into this kind of stuff. Like, there was probably not a day, if we weren't helping her through the process of being a patient, which is normal, there was some kind of battle within healthcare and just trying to mitigate errors.
Wow, what a ordeal you and your family and your mother went through. Just shocking. In hindsight, looking back, you've interspersed in her story, your story, your family's story. What are some tips that you can tell people to how to be A, the best advocate for someone else, and B, when you're the patient, how to be an advocate? I think that's a little risky. I think you need both. And you think you need to have the confidence to advocate for yourself. But in my experience, I always needed somebody else in the room as well, because I never knew when something was going to make me dizzy, et cetera. So what are some tips you have?
You know, from day one, this isn't, I guess, normal, but well, first off, my sister went to every single appointment. I was working at the time. She never missed an appointment. She always took notes. She wrote down all the meds, made sure she asked the questions. We would talk beforehand before appointments, always needing somebody to be there, because if you're a patient and you're being told that you have, you know, it doesn't have to be cancer. It could be diabetes. It could be heart disease. As a patient, and if it's severe, you're thinking about your own mortality and you don't have the mental capacity to absorb all the stuff that the doctors are giving you. So it's important to have someone there. In a lot of states, also, New York State is one of them, you're allowed to record on your cell phone. Some states, and it's not like you're trying to record as a gotcha, you're trying to record because sometimes, you know, when you have a 10-minute window with a specialist, they talk so fast, you don't remember what they said.
And oftentimes they say scary things or great big words that you're trying to hear, and they're already on to the third sentence after you're trying to figure out what was that word they just
exactly.
said.
Exactly. And or if they say this crazy word, you didn't write it down, you didn't spell it right, so you don't even know how to Google it, you know? yeah. I ran into a problem with Dr. Google after she had surgery. I always tell people, you have to educate yourself. You're never going to take the place of a doctor. You didn't go to medical school. They learned a lot, and you're not smarter than they am. Because they have a white coat, we get white coat syndrome. White coat syndrome is when you see a white coat, that person is always right. A lot of people get high blood pressure when they're in the doctor's office. They get anxiety. You know, they're worried about, they're thinking about insurance, bills, you name it. So you lose the ability to find your voice and ask the important questions. So after my mom got out of rehab and went home, they were doing cleanup chemo. Cleanup chemo was to get all the microscopic that they didn't get. And it was 4 days inpatient. My sisters, her and I are different. We work perfectly together as a team, like yin and yang. She's more conservative, always has a plan for everything, detail oriented. And me, I'm more of the, I'll call it the heavy, the pain in the neck, the person that's not going to tolerate certain things, et cetera, et cetera. So my mom's first day of inpatient chemotherapy, my subject line in the text I got from her was effing terrible. And my sister doesn't curse. So I Googled the med that she was on and I went over there. I took one look at my mother and she had every symptom of toxicity except coma and death. Labor Day weekend, I called the oncologist and I said, listen, and I knew he had a boat, so he was going to go away. I said, you need to get here. My mom, something's not right with the chemo. I think she's toxic. He came and he said, she's fine. For Connie, we're going for hope. This is all normal. And us, and I regret it, as a family, we're like, okay, all right, well, okay, let's do the second round. The next day, again, befriend your nurses. The head nurse called me on my cell phone. I was home. She goes, Melissa, you need to get here. This isn't the Connie that I know. I have orders to hang another bag and I don't like the way she looks. And I went, my sister went, my dad went, and one of his colleagues went. A colleague, as you know, when you have stand-ins, they barely read the file. They don't know what the patient looks like when they're happy, when they're sad, when they're healthy, when they're not. And for cancer, it's a whole nother bunch of things that you have to worry about. But he came in, I told him everything that I had looked up, and he basically told me to stay off the internet. She was fine, keep going. So again, I regret it, but we kept going. Next day I went in the morning. Again, I always say in the book too, go to the hospital different times. If their hours of visitation start at 8, get there before 8. Doctors usually make rounds between 7 in the morning and 10. It's very helpful, especially if the patient is very sick, for you to be there when doctors are making rounds. If you don't know when they make rounds, call their offices and find out, because you need to hear what they're saying. Because so many times I would, like, if I missed rounds or my sister missed rounds, you know, Ma, what did he say? And we needed more information. I went to the hospital and I found my mother flat. Her arm was hanging off the bed. She had throw up coming out of her mouth, and she was 2 seconds away from aspirating. So at that point, my head exploded.
Metaphorically.
Yeah. Now I don't trust you. I wound up sleeping there. My sister and I slept there until Monday afternoon. The original oncologist came. I was leaning up against her bathroom door, and he took one look at my mother and he said, "You're right. She was toxic." And at the time I was in the reinsurance industry. I said, "I'm in reinsurance." I said, "This is your job." And she was poisoned. And when you're already sick and you're poisoned by chemotherapy, you're lucky if you survive it. I mean, she lost 2 weeks of her life. She doesn't even remember. My husband works in the Bronx. The priest was called like 3 times, and we're not even religious. He just came because things were so bad. Another takeaway is trust your gut. Educate yourself. I wanted desperately for her to get a second opinion down in the city, in New York City. She wanted to stay local. She liked her doctors, which is okay. And she wasn't a city person. So I understand that. A lot of people worry that insurance is not going to pay for a second opinion. 95% of the time they will, because sometimes it can help. It can actually, I worked in the industry for 20 years. It can lower the claim if somebody has a different alternative to, you know, what some other doctor may or may not want to do. I mean, this is the biggest difference in second opinion that I've ever heard. Since I've written the book, I've had a lot of people reach out to me through my website or through social media. And there was a woman that she had a tumor behind her eye. She went to 2 prestigious surgeons in Manhattan. One of them said, "We need to take the tumor out, of course. We're going to go through your eye to do it." Another doctor said, "We're going to take it out from the top of your head." So she wound up getting it out through her eye. What he said to her, which makes sense, is that if you sold your house and you're moving, do you take the furniture out the front door or do you take it out the roof? I mean, that's the deviation and variation of alternative treatment approaches that you can get from prestigious doctors. I also tell people, you know, there's those health grades on the internet. Some people, maybe they had a bad experience with the doctor, that they'll give them 1 star or something. You know, you'll get the outliners. But if you read through it and it's important enough, you can kind of get the gist or the vibe of how good or bad a doctor is. It doesn't mean that, like for my mom, for example, that she would have survived the cancer because it was a very aggressive cancer. You know, if we research the best refrigerator we're going to put in our kitchen, why wouldn't you research the doctor? You know what I mean? And that goes for even if you're uninsured or if you have Medicaid. You know, I know it's hard, and I'm very fortunate because I have very good benefits, but you can still research the doctors. And because they wear that white coat does not mean that they're always right. Another thing that people don't understand is that if you're in a teaching hospital and there's mistakes like we had, you are allowed to say no more students. And we tried for about 4 months to be good teammates and say, of course, you got to learn somehow. So, you know, a lot of times in a room, there's 10 people. And it's, it kind of stinks for the patient because it's kind of like if you picture like a fishbowl and, you know, when a goldfish is sick because they start fishing, swimming weird. And you got 10 people looking at you.
I call it the dog and pony show.
Yeah.
One of my diagnoses is this is a very rare autoimmune. You don't see it too often. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, you're at a teaching hospital. Let's bring them all in so they get to see what it looks like firsthand.
Right. And you're somebody's paper.
Which is great on the one side. Like you, I was like, okay, I want to be useful. I want to make some mm-hmm. meaning of what I'm going through. Yet I can see many places where the continuity was so disruptive.
Yeah, no, it's very hard. And for me, for example, You know, a couple things. Like it took me 10 years to write this book, and it took me 10 years for a lot of reasons. One is because I was so angry for so long because of so many mistakes. Like, I understand I'm not the first person to lose a parent to cancer or a loved one to cancer. Little kids die of cancer. I'm not special, but I was angry and I had rage because my thing was, my mom suffered and she didn't have to because of mistakes. Like, even something like, you know, and this is just human error. I remember walking in and she was thrown up because the nurse forgot to make the Zofran run down into her IV because she was nauseous. Like, that's human error. I get that. But reading a CAT scan wrong, having the wrong bracelet, prescribing a med that's just totally erroneous, those things are just not acceptable. Finding out you have cancer through a nurse by accident. You know, I was full of rage for a long time. And even though I worked in psych ERs, I ran groups, I worked in step down houses, I did psych education for patients, I was terrible at grief. My dad and my sister were much better at it. I couldn't accept it. You know, my mom eventually had hospice and me and my sister stayed. It was Saturday to Saturday that she lasted in house. And it's weird, the whole hospice thing. I don't know if you've been through it or not, but as you're sitting there, my mom had made the decision, no more treatment. Of course, that's your choice. We totally were for, she had had enough. But at the same time, I remember sitting in the living room and I didn't move because I kept watching. She started hospice on a Saturday. She died the following Saturday. By Wednesday, she didn't get off the couch. I was sitting there watching to make sure her chest was rising up and down because I was afraid for it to stop. But at the same time, you're in hospice. That's what you're waiting for. It's such a weird space to be. And every day, a hospice person comes and, you know, they see if you have edema in your leg, they might listen to some, your heart, your lungs, whatever. And every day they say, today's going to be the day. Today's going to be the day. Well, today's not going to be the day. And I remember at one point, my sister and I were like, maybe we need to leave because maybe mommy's not going to do this while we're here. But then we're afraid to leave. It's just such a weird spot to be in. But after she passed, and me, you know, I know all the diagnoses in the DSM-5, all of it. Did stuff with PTSD myself with soldiers and wounded warriors. I had major PTSD. I just didn't tell anybody. I saw her dying on the couch all the time. Anytime I wasn't busy, I saw it when I was at work. I saw it when I was driving. It robbed me of my sleep. I got down to 115 pounds. I was a 00. I was still working. I had to get junior clothes even taken in because it was corporate. So I had to wear corporate attire. People at my job, you know, I was offered from human resources. They were great. They're like, you know, Miss, you should really take 6 months, you know, to get your head together. Cause they knew I look sick. I look like I had cancer. I was so skinny.
And that was from the grief and the PTSD. Correct?
Yeah. I was a wreck. And it wound up setting off. I bought myself a week in the hospital with colitis. It bought me a week, you know, because stress will cause any autoimmune to flare up. I wasn't eating. If I ate 500 calories a day, that was a lot. I should have taken my job up on that because they offered it was paid time off. But I felt like because they were so good to me while she was sick for 9 months and I was a manager, I felt like I kind of owed them. And I felt like if I stay working, it's going to keep my mind occupied because I'm falling apart. But it did the opposite. I should have taken the time. I was textbook depression. I was textbook grief. I was textbook PTSD, acute anxiety, you name it. I had it. It took me a year and a half to finally reach out and get help. And I'm a little ashamed about it because I was, you know, I was eating Xanax like it was candy and I knew better. You know, if you read the book, I started out with a letter to my mother and I tell her basically what has gone on since she's gone, things that she's missed, but how I handled myself. And as you know, with autoimmune, one thing leads to another. When I got the colitis and they wound up taking my colon out and I have Crohn's now, but it's a long story, but they put me on steroids. You know, that's kind of the fix-all. I was planning my husband's birthday. We were having 30 people at the house. Again, I was walking around 115 pounds and all of a sudden I had a grand mal seizure in my kitchen out of nowhere. you know, I was blue. The ambulance showed up, and because I just got discharged from the hospital, I had Xanax in my pocketbook and I had an opiate in my pocketbook because I, you know, that's what I was discharged with. I didn't take them. I kept them in my purse because I had a toddler. I didn't want them accessible. So I kept them on my person. But when the ambulance showed up and they saw those meds in my purse, they were like, oh, you know, this is why. Thankfully, when I got to the hospital, they ran a toxicology screening and everything was negative. There's no opiates in my system. There's no benzodiazepines, nothing. I told them that, but of course, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So I had a grand mal seizure out of nowhere. Why the hell did that happen? And after a bunch of different appointments with different neurologists throughout New York, they found out that I was predisposed because one side of my hippocampus was larger than the other. So it predisposed me to seizures. They decided to come out at 40. I think it came out because you have seizures because of lack of sleep. I didn't sleep for probably a year. I mean, if I slept 3 hours, that was a lot. I was also on very high doses of prednisone, which also steals your sleep. But also I had organic reasons for these seizures. I kind of write about that in the book of how my mental health caused my physical health to decline. And quite frankly, almost took me out because I had a major head injury from my head hitting the floor and the tile in my kitchen. In New York State, you have a grand mal seizure, you lose your license a year. So I had to stay home from work a year and, you know, kind of compounded things. And, you know, it just kind of all started from there.
Wow. What a story. I'm kind of at a loss for words, Melissa. We need to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we'll hear more of Melissa's and her family story. We'll be right back.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
You came across someone struggling with hunger. How would you recognize them? Would you notice an 8-year-old girl who's not excited for summer break
because she may not be having lunch again until September?
Or a war veteran who's having a hard time landing a job and getting back on his feet? I am the 1 in 8 Americans who struggle with hunger. I am hunger in America.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Research shows we apologize up to 10 times a day, and most of the time, we say sorry as a response to someone else's mistake. What if we thanked people instead of all that unnecessary apologizing? So instead of saying, sorry, I'm rambling, you say, thank you for listening. Join us at ProjectForgive.com, a free non-religious resource on global forgiveness.
Do you want to be a better leader, have better relationships, become more self-aware, be a better communicator? Hi, I'm Sharon Saylor, best-selling author, professional speaker, and executive coach, and my life passion is empowering professionals to be the best that they can be. After years of working with professionals, I've discovered the 7 things nobody is telling you that can cost you your clients, sales, and even your career. And I want to give it to you free. You've heard my show, you know my passion, and maybe we'll be working together sooner rather than later. So go grab this ebook now to find out the 7 things that's costing you big time over at SharonSaylor.com/radio gift.
Opiates has taken everything and everyone I've ever loved away from me. Everything.
I blew my ankle out and I got prescribed pain pills by my doctor.
If making my detox public is gonna help somebody, I'm all for it. I just wish I would have had a warning.
Opioid dependence can happen after just 5 days. Know the truth, spread the truth. A message from Truth, the Ad Council, and ONDCP.
Welcome back from that quick commercial break. Tonight we're having Melissa Malamphy on, and she's written a wonderful memoir called Not in Vain, A Promise Kept. And this is the story of her mother lived through what I have to say was probably one of the worst that I've heard of patient neglect. Well, Melissa, as you've go through the process of when you lost your mother and saw the need for patient advocacy from that perspective of helping someone else. And now you're thinking and you're going through this process of needing to be your own advocate for yourself. What are some tips and techniques that you have for people that they can say, oh, wow, I need to implement that right away?
There's a lot of things. Like I always say, find your voice, find your why. There's a lot of people, like my sister's very non-confrontational. Some people are not comfortable, and I say finding your voice. If you want to ask a doctor a question, you don't have to ask it in a way that you're trying to be cocky or nasty. You have the right to ask for stuff. Another example is, and this is a really crazy story. This happened to me last year. I have a bunch of GI issues. This is where I had to advocate for myself. With Crohn's, you have chronic stomach ache. I have no colon. I've had multiple surgeries on my abdomen. My husband wound up taking me to the emergency room. I didn't want to go. It was during COVID, but I went anyway. Doubled over in pain with my stomach. 7 hours I was there. They weren't busy. They gave me some pain meds. They didn't even do a blood draw. The nurse came in and she started to take the stuff on my chest, you know, IV, and they started taking everything apart and saying, you're getting discharged. And I'm in so much pain, I can't even get to my cell phone because I would have called 911. So at one point I cursed. I said, this is blank, 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 ridiculous. And I became a code gray. I never knew what a code gray was. A code gray is if you're a sort of pain in the neck patient. Thankfully, I went to get up to go to the bathroom. And I passed out unconscious. I woke up, two nurses were on each side of me. My blood pressure was 70 over 30 and my beats per minute were 168. I was dying. My red blood cell count was 2 when they finally took a CBC. They had to call the hospitalist in. Long story short, my stomach, it's called gastric volvulus. It's very rare and you don't survive it usually. It flipped and pulled off my spleen. How? I have no idea, but it did. And 50% of the blood that was supposed to be in my body was in my stomach. Had I not passed out, they were sending me home. Discharge papers were already written up and I wouldn't have woke up. My son and my husband would have found me that morning. Next day, I went for a CT, like 6 doctors in the room. Trauma surgeon came in. It was something out of Grey's Anatomy, flew me down the hallway. You know, the nurses were putting shunts in me and putting my hair in a thing on the way to the OR. And I woke up 2 days later in ICU. He saved my life. The trauma surgeon saved my life. So where I'm going with this, in a post-COVID world, if we want to call it that, now more than ever, you have to find your voice. And I was in so much pain. Had I been able to, I would have called 911 or my husband, Anthony, he would have came over because I knew something was really wrong and they were discharging me. When I finally got discharged 13 days later, I wrote to the person in charge of the emergency room of the hospital and the CEO of the hospital. I did that for my mother too, as well. And I said, I don't want to mess with people's livelihood. I understand everybody's stressed out. Everybody's got pandemic fatigue, but how do you have a patient come into a hospital and not even do a CBC? And they weren't even busy. You know, I said, I don't have to even make up anything because the record stands for itself. I explained to him every single thing that happened. And I became like the case of the week because it was so rare. And the hospitalist had to actually change the record. You could see it because I always ask for it. So another tip, always get your physical records. Nowadays, when everything is an e-file, a lot of doctors will just cut and paste stuff in there. It's not actually your file. If you're in a hospital, before you leave, ask the nurse, sign a paper to bring your physical file with you, because especially with somebody with something chronic like you and I have with autoimmune, you don't know when you're going to go to the doctor next. And it's good to have that. If you get something in radiology, a lot of doctors, especially the ones I go to in the city, they don't really want to see the impression or the report of the doctor up here. They want to see the CD for themselves because their assessment may be different than the assessment of the doctor up here. So I always say, ask for your records. There should be no charge for them. They should be available to you. And if they say go to the portal, in my experience, even the best portals, and it's not the actual file, it's a form, it's copy and pasted, and you're lucky if you have doctor notes in it. So that's very important. I wrote the people in charge and I said, you know, this happened. again, I don't want to mess with people's livelihood, but because you're in charge of all these people, you need to talk about this, because had I been discharged, I wouldn't have woke up. That's what I mean about speaking out. I mean, I dealt with CEOs all the time at my job. They're people just like you and I. They're no different. And they don't want to get notes from people like you and me. I'm never nasty in them, but they need to know, because another thing, and you know, stop me if I'm just going on too much, but like for my mom, every 2 weeks they had an interdisciplinary meeting on her case, and that was all the doctors together. So I said to them, if me and my sister are spending, you know, I'll just make it up, 75% of our time with her, I know if she had breakthrough nausea, I know if she had breakthrough pain and didn't want to bother a nurse, I know if she ambulated to the bathroom and just, or she didn't and just didn't want to bother anybody, because again, remember, they don't want to be a burden. I know if she ate, I know if she's depressed, I know if she's given up, I know her mindset. I know I can't be at your meetings because it's patient confidentiality and you're professionals, but if I can't have the first 5 minutes, can I just write a note to tell you all my observations prior to this meeting that, in my opinion, are important to my mother's care that you may not know about, that you need to know about? Like, she was in the hospital for a solid week, and the only thing I saw her drink was 3 boosts. They don't know that, you know, until they weigh you on the bed. And I would say, like, nowadays, I mean, my neighbor in December, the county sent a wellness check, and they came to the wrong house. This man didn't have anything. We always helped him out. 68 years old, nicest man in the world. He told me he fell outside. He was always working outside, and he didn't fall. He had an aggressive cancer. It took me a day to convince him to get into the ambulance. It took 4 of us to get him into the ambulance. He went to the hospital, and you know, we spoke on the phone, and I'm not vaccinated, so I had to test every time I wanted to see him. This was last December. So the one day I go, and you know, he doesn't have much family. I go and visit him. He's animated. He's happy. He's cognitively intact. He's saying, I'm going to beat it. I gave him a donut. It was like I gave him $1,000. We were joking. I made the nurse get him out of the bed, sit in a chair. He went to the bathroom on his own. The whole thing. It was a nice visit. I was there for about 4 hours. Not even 48 hours later, I go and I see on masking tape on his door, DNR. Written on masking tape. The same man that I was joking with 48 hours before is naked in the bed in a diaper. They had stuck a port in his stomach to drain the ascites. He was wailing in pain. He had no glasses on. He didn't have the call switch. I'm like, what the heck happened in 2 days? Not even 2 days. He was left there to die. Finally, the PA came up and she says, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I just saw him 2 days ago. What happened? We talked and she's like, he needs to ask for his medicine. I said, does he look like he's in any blank, blank, blank condition to ask for medication? He doesn't even know my name. After a little heated discussion, about 4 hours later, the pharmacy came up with morphine. And as many people know, when you're end-stage cancer, eventually, if you're on morphine, your central nervous system will shut down, and that helps you pass in comfort, we think. I called his sister. I said, you need to get here. She came. The pharmacy brought it up. Within 2 shots, I saw the look, the same look I saw with my mom, and the next day he passed away. My question is, what if I didn't go? You know, what if I didn't go? He could have lasted that way for a week. And I'm not saying that to be egotistical, what if I didn't go? But I'm saying that because it makes me very angry. Because the fact that they just had masking tape on his door and DNR, and the fact that he had Medicaid and not a dime to his name, who fights for him? And I wound up writing that person in charge of hospital. I mean, I'm just making lots of friends. I just said, listen, don't take it from me. Look at the record. But this is what I walked into, and it's not acceptable. I don't care if he's the owner of Amazon or the guy that I helped put brakes on his car last summer because he's got nothing. It's not okay. CEO wrote back to me is that, you know, we should always allow the family to be at the bedside. If the patient is incapable of asking for the medication, we need to be ahead of that. Like they say, stay ahead of nausea. You need to stay ahead of pain too. He said all the right things. So I hope he implements them.
Wow. Well, Melissa, such an ordeal that you've been through in going through the medical system here in the United States. And thank you for sharing your tips and the things that we need to look out for, things that we need to be aware of if either ourselves or our loved ones need someone to stand up for them. I really appreciate all that you've shared. Want the audience to know that you can find her book. It's called Not in Vain, A Promise Kept. Her website is Melissa Mulamphy, MULLAMPHY.com. We'll have that over at understandingautoimmune.com. Find all of her information. We'll have it up there with the show. Thank you so much, Melissa, for sharing right from your heart how this continuing ordeal has changed you, and appreciate advocating for people who don't have a voice.
I appreciate the opportunity. And like I say, like, you know, my dad will ask me sometimes, oh, Misty, are you selling any books? And I'm like, Dad, that's not my goal. My goal is to get the message out and to not have people suffer like mommy did and like our family did, and teach them and give them the tools to find their voice. If that happens, and if I could be a part of it, then my job's done.
And that's very true. When your book came across our desk here at the Autoimmune Hour, I was reading it with a knowing nod of my head on almost every sentence, because been there, done that, or family members for me when I was at my worst had been there, done that for me too. And I know how important it is to stand up, and to stand up for yourself and to stand up for those who can't. So thank you very much for sharing your story, and deepest sympathies on your loss. Thank you for listening to our show tonight, and have a great week, whatever your adventures. Join me next week for another brand new episode. Enjoy.
The information provided on the Autoimmune Hour, Understanding Autoimmune, and Life Interrupted Radio, including the websites understandingautoimmune.com and lifeinterruptedradio.com, plus social media, is for educational purposes only. What you read, hear, and see on the Autoimmune Hour, Understanding Autoimmune, and Life Interrupted Radio, and its websites and other media outlets, is based on experience only. The information should never be used for any legal, diagnostic, or treatment purposes.